And I do think that the lack of disclosure, the lack of transparency, the lack of wealth inequality being part of our, in particular, political discourse, does mean we're not trying to solve the problem. We're not working towards it. It's not on the political agenda the same way it is in the U.S.
Hello, welcome to Strictly Money, where your finance and prosperity meet. I'm Sejal Patel. If you were to ask most Canadians whether our income gap is smaller or larger compared to the U.S., most would say it was smaller. In fact, when it comes to the wealth gap, most Canadians would say that we are in a better position than our U.S. counterparts. However, you'd be in for a bit of a surprise because the way Statistics Canada gathers this data is actually not reflecting reality. And it's been exposed in a new report called The Billionaire Blind Spot. Dan Skilleter is the author of this report. He is also the director of policy at Social Capital Partners. Dan previously served as a policy advisor to the Premier of Ontario and the Minister of Finance. And he joins me now. Welcome to Strictly Money, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
So as I said in the intro, you authored this report, Billionaire Blind Spot, and you say that there's evidence suggesting that the wealthiest Canadians own nearly as much of our country's wealth as our U.S. counterparts. And the problem is the way that we've collected the data. So what did you find?
Well, I found something that was pretty surprising to me. So I thought it was worth putting in a report, and because maybe other people might find it surprising and interesting as well, which was that, you know, when you look at the wealth inequality between Canadians, so, you know, the amount of wealth owned by the very wealthiest Canadians, let's say the top 0.1%, a few thousand families, and you get a sense of what they actually own as a percentage of Canadian wealth, it looks pretty similar to the American statistics. And that's one of the key ways that we go about measuring wealth inequality. So I found that to be surprising. I found it to be troubling. And I found it to be in contradiction to the narrative that we often hear in Canada about inequality. And that's mostly because I think we focus almost exclusively on income inequality when we have the discussions in Canada.
Yeah, we do. And for those who are listening or watching this, I should say, so you found that the top 1%, the U.S. owns about 35.7% of the wealth. In Canada, it's about 26%. So yes, we're lower, but I think that's going to come as a surprise for a lot of people.
Yeah. And it gets even closer, the higher up the chain you go. So when we're talking about the top 0.1%, the difference is that in the U.S. it's 16%, but here in Canada it's 12%. So that gap is pretty slim.
Yeah, it's much narrower. Then, Dan, let me ask you, because I know there's a problem with the way they've collected the data, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but how did you then reconcile the gap? So, you know, how did you go about sort of collecting that information so it did represent the numbers a little bit closer to reality?
Yeah, so I guess to back up or zoom out in terms of how I would have access to these statistics, how anyone else would. There is a mechanism that is done by Statistics Canada in terms of trying to get a picture of wealth levels and wealth inequality levels in Canada. And it's a survey that they do approximately every 3 to 6 years. So it doesn't happen very often. And it's not, you know, an annual data set we can look at and see changes on a very regular basis. And what they do is they send out approximately 20,000 survey requests to Canadians around the country and asking them to sit down for a 45-minute survey. So these are in-depth surveys where they ask you about your family's wealth position in terms of all the different assets you might own. So it's not just about what's in your bank account. You know, they would want to know about the property you owned, stocks and bonds, everything like that, so that they can get a picture of wealth. And what I found and what makes it hard to find this data is that they essentially don't ask the wealthiest Canadians to participate in the survey. In fact, the most recent survey we have information for, which was 2019, the richest family that was captured in the survey had a net worth of less than $30 million. So, you know, that is, without a doubt, a wealthy family. But for that to be the highest point of the richest family in Canada, within government statistics really shows you how misleading the information can be, because we know through publicly available information that there are multiple families that have tens of billions in net worth around the country.
Yeah. And I can already see a lot of problems with this because, first of all, as you pointed out, it's only sent out every couple of years. So it's not up to date and accurate. And if you're sampling by sending out, you know, maybe 20,000 and assuming it is volunteering that information, I can imagine not a lot of people will want to volunteer that kind of information anyway.
Yeah. And a similar survey is done in the US, which I argue in my report, they do a better job of, you know, having a statistically sound report that has better and more accurate data. But it's been quantified and found that the richer your family is, the less likely they will want to participate in a voluntary survey like this. So it's already just harder to capture wealthy families. So in terms of the data that we've been talking about and already and comparing just how close the U.S. Wealth concentration is to Canada, luckily, over the course of the last, I want to say, 8 to 10 years, multiple academic and organizations have taken it upon themselves to take a look at what does exist through Statistics Canada's data, also take a look at what exists in the public realm in terms of the Forbes billionaire list that does capture a good slice of the richest families in Canada and their approximate net worth, and then use various methods to sort of add in those incredibly rich families into the existing Canadian data sets. And that is how you get these more realistic percentages that I've been talking about. So the data that I'm shining a light on is that, according to Statistics Canada, the wealthiest families actually own, you know, a pretty small percentage of overall wealth. But it's when you look at all these various academic studies that have been done in Canada and in the U.S. to look at what it means to synthetically, or, you know, to add the richest families to the data set, what it does to the distribution. And so that's in terms of what, you know, my report does, and if people are more interested and want to take a deeper look, it's sort of doing a larger analysis of all the different great research that's been done over the years, both in Canada and the U.S., and kind of laying it out in the easy to read format.
Yeah, and I'll be sure to put the link to the report in the show notes, Dan. I want to talk about the misconceptions that this can lead to, and honestly, in the behavior, because, you know, I often say that Canadians, not all, but some tend to, you know, thumb their nose at the U.S. and saying, hey, you know, look at them. They're so much worse off, and this, you know, we extreme wealth gap, and it's not so bad in Canada. And if we don't actually have the data, I think it can lead to one, misconceptions and different behaviors that might not be in our best interest. And I want to get your thoughts on that. You know, does it lead to complacency, and why is it important to actually reflect better data?
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that the contrast to the U.S. was purposeful in terms of, you know, setting it up that way, because we do have a sense here as Canadians, and, you know, I do myself, and my friends and family all did when I was having this discussion with them, that we are far less unequal here than in the U.S. And to a certain extent, that's true, especially when it comes to income. So the income inequality in Canada is not nearly as sharp as it is in the U.S. And some of your viewers might be familiar with a concept called the Gini coefficient or the Gini index.
No, explain that. Yeah.
Oh, no. It's a sort of a very popular in the policy, politics, statistics world measurement of how unequal a country is or a subnational jurisdiction is. So the number 0 represents total equality, meaning that everyone would have the exact same income. And the number 1 would mean that one person literally has all of the income. And so it's a measurement between 0 and 1 to give you an indication of how unequal a country is. And that it's entirely predicated on income data. And, you know, when you look at that, which is an important measurement, Canada is less unequal than the U.S. by a considerable degree. So I think that feeds into the myth we have in Canada that we have a stronger social safety net, which we do, and we have less inequality in some cases than we do in the U.S. But what I wanted to shine a light on was that when you look at wealth, not income, things are not nearly so sunny a picture when it comes to Canada. And I do think that the lack of disclosure, the lack of transparency, and not that the lack of wealth inequality being part of our, in particular, political discourse, does mean we're not trying to solve the problem. We're not working towards it. It's not on the political agenda the same way it is in the U.S. And I think that that's a problem.
Yeah, and I have to agree, because at the end of the day, it's wealth what matters. That, you know, that's what at the end is going to determine the quality of life and whether you have enough for retirement. So we're going to take a quick break, Dan, to hear from our sponsors, BMO ETFs. And when we come back, I want to dive a little bit more into maybe some of those solutions that you have in mind to fix some of these issues around the wealth gap. So we'll take a break and we'll be right back.
Are you looking to enhance the level of cash flow from your investments? BMO ETFs has you covered with their Covered Call ETFs. These ETFs generate cash flow from two sources, the dividend yield from the underlying securities and the premium generated from selling the call options. BMO Covered Call ETFs strike a balance between generating cash flow and participating in the growth of rising markets with your experienced portfolio management team and effective strategy with over 10 years of history. BMO ETFs is the largest covered call ETF provider in Canada, covering 13 covered call ETFs across a range of strategies across regions, countries, and sectors. Visit BMOETFs.com to learn more. Please read the ETF facts or prospectus of the BMO ETFs before investing.
Welcome back. Dan, I want to talk about the wealth gap, because there is this feeling that the middle class especially has been left behind and that the middle class is shrinking. And a lot of people are feeling left behind. When it comes to the wealth gap, though, I know everyone has a different idea of, you know, what's fair. How do you even go about addressing it? And I want to get your thoughts around that.
Yeah. So I think that on the fairness question, there's different ways of tackling it. The report that I wrote isn't focused exclusively on figuring out, you know, how could we bring down wealth inequality in Canada? But the organization that I work for, Social Capital Partners, we're a bit of a think tank and an advocacy organization, and we certainly have ideas and are working towards some of those ends. And I think that taxation is part of it. And part of the discussion around wealth inequality over income inequality, I hope, is going to center a conversation when we are looking at tax, of not just looking at taxing income, but looking at taxing, you know, actual wealth. So the federal budget came out last week.
I was going to ask you about it. Yeah. What you thought?
We saw, for the first time in a long time, a movement on capital gains. And so, you know, the inclusion rate, meaning how much of the of a gain you actually put into your income taxes, it was 75% for a long time. Then it got moved down to 50% in, I think, 2000. And now the government's decided that it should go back up to not where it was, but partway there to 66%. And that is, you know, they've done some interesting buffers to provide greater one-time exemptions for certain folks so that it's really trying to impact the wealthiest. And I'd say that that was a very concerted tax idea to go after the wealthiest Canadians who are living off of capital, living off of the, you know, the wealth that they have accumulated already and are generating returns on. And so I think that I was personally really pleased to see that that was where they're going to increase revenue on the one hand, but also to create more fairness within the tax system.
Yeah. I guess a lot of people would argue, and I guess I'm in another camp, and I said this before. I said, I don't actually have an issue when you're taxing or increasing capital gains tax on, say, investment properties or something like that. And I know you and I have discussed this before, because, you know, it's not necessarily generating jobs and employment and really contributing to the economy. I guess my concern has been around going after some of the businesses, because business owners do take risk. And I feel like this is going to capture a lot more people than what they say, you know, the top 0.13%. It seems like there's a lot more people included in that.
Yeah, and that's certainly worthy of a debate, and how well they could have even attempted to target it. Tax is always a blunt instrument that's going to have, it's very difficult to get exactly at the types of people and the activities that you want without capturing those that you don't. But, you know, I would say that they've put a $250,000 kind of amount annually that you are still at the 50% rate. So I think it really is meant to capture people who are on a regular basis having very large gains that would be over $250,000. And they also increase for small business owners the lifetime capital gains exemption to $1.25 million. That is meant to, you know, alleviate tax when someone's selling a business. And that was a significant gain. I think it was at about $1 million previously. So they've increased it by a significant percentage on that end too. So they definitely did take measures to mitigate it. I think that probably for most small business owners, it might even work out to be beneficial in terms of how much tax they save. But, you know, like I said, tax is a blunt instrument and depends on what you're trying to prioritize.
Yeah, you know, and I always say, I mean, tax is a really important tool to try to level the playing field or you know, have these targeted policies. Dad, I'm curious, do you think it's easy for Canada to implement some of these policies when we are next door to the biggest capital market? Because, you know, a lot of people will argue, well, and I argue this, like, capital goes where it's loved, you know, and it moves pretty quickly. And unfortunately, when you are sort of next door to an economy that's very much, you know, skewed towards capitalism, we can't necessarily work in just isolation. We have to think about those consequences. And I'm just wondering what you think.
I think that that's the argument that's had an incredible amount of purchase within political circles at the federal and provincial level for most of my adult life. I think that view has been very heavily represented, and there's definitely merit to it. But there's an aspect of it too that, you know, it could be a race to the bottom. And it's about, I think some of these decisions are, what kind of a society do we want to live in? What sort of benefits do we want to be providing people, and how do we fund it? And so there's a lot that, you know, we began this discussion by talking about how we Canadians often, you know, snub their nose at the U.S. in terms of some of the things that they don't have there, in terms of more social, we have more social cohesion, we have a better social safety net, we have perceived levels of, you know, equality. And those are some of the things that you would be trading away if you just decided to emulate the U.S. in every capacity.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think, you know, I don't know what this answer is either, Dan, and I always appreciate different viewpoints and yours as well, because what I do, and as you know, I do this show to try to help educate people to manage their money better, but also so they're educated enough to vote for policies that make sense. And what I am seeing is that a lot of people feel like, you know, I'm doing the right things. I work 40 hours or 50 hours. I really do try to watch my money, and I'm not getting ahead. I'm falling behind. And so this is a conversation that I think really needs to be had. Dan, now the report does have sort of three recommendations for the federal government and Statistics Canada. Can you just walk us through that? Or do you want me to run through some of those and you can make some comments about it? I know one is ensure that the wealthiest Canadians are captured by creating new tiers.
Yeah, so that is by far the most important recommendation. If that one wasn't done, the other two wouldn't be as meaningful. But essentially, what I'm recommending and asking the government to do is to actually survey the billionaires. So as we talked about earlier, the richest families that get captured by the survey, you know, have tens of millions in net worth, not tens of billions. And that is because so much wealth is concentrated at the very top. When you don't have any representation as part of your surveys and your samples, it dramatically skews the numbers downwards and gives us a false impression that wealth inequality is not so bad here. So they have a good survey. They've got mechanisms to determine who they want to be oversampling. That the pipes, the plumbing to do this is readily available to them. But what I think that they need to do for upcoming surveys is to ensure that they are isolating and reaching out to and sending surveys to those that they have a good reason to believe are, you know, within the top 1,000 families. So we're talking folks with hundreds of millions or billions in net worth, so that we can actually believe the results that we see out of the upcoming statistics in future years.
And then, Dan, you said modernize also how the wealth inequality data is published.
I did. So yeah, the data that you and I talked about today, which is looking at the top 1% of Canadian families and the top 0.1%, which is really where a lot of the global discussion is when it comes to wealth inequality, those numbers you can't actually extract from Statistics Canada. You have to, I don't want to, you know, bore the audience with the method you have to take to get those numbers, but suffice it to say, in the U.S. and other countries, within using Google within 5 minutes, I could find those numbers for these other countries. In Canada, you can't, and they don't publish those. You have to find, you either have to do it yourself using the raw data, or you have to search for academics who have done it for you. So I would say that needs to be revamped, because really the discussion around wealth inequality has really taken on the texture and focus of what do the top 0.1 or, you know, top billionaire families really own, and what is the gap in wealth between them and the 99% of the rest of the country.
Yeah. And look, we can't solve problems accurately if we don't have accurate data. So I'm so glad that you were able to come on and shine the light on this. And let's hope we get somewhere with this. Do you have any idea if anyone's taking your recommendations and whether we will see a change?
I'm not sure. We've certainly sent it to the appropriate folks in government. We timed it such that the 2023 data from the wealth survey that was done in 2023 hasn't yet been published. It should be published any day or month now. So that means that soon they will be looking towards what they're going to do for their next survey. So we were, you know, purposefully putting this out because we thought we could interject at the right time in the process for them to consider some structural changes before they actually begin the process for the next survey. So we will continue to cross our fingers, and we will continue to prompt them. And who knows, we might see something much better next time.
Yeah, let's hope. Dan, really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for coming on.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Now, before you don't know about this, before I let you go, I always ask my guests three rapid fire questions. I like to try to humanize, you know, personal finance. So are you ready to play?
Let's go.
Okay. What is the best financial advice you've ever received?
Put everything in ETFs and then just don't ever look at the app.
That's a good one. Well, if you diversify your portfolio properly, you probably don't have to look at it very often, right?
Yeah, the monitoring it on a regular basis is not good for your psyche and not a good use of time is, I guess, the piece of wisdom that I've come across.
I have to agree with that. What is the worst financial advice then you've received?
Put money into crypto after the bust. I don't know. People were out there trying to sell a lot of interesting financial products, including some people I know. And I was glad I stayed on the sidelines.
Yeah, FOMO is real. And unfortunately, I like you, I know a lot of people who, I don't want to say that no one should ever do it. But when you're gambling and you're doing it without understanding what you're investing in and not having sort of that proper risk management around it, you tend to run into a lot of trouble. And we certainly saw that. Okay, last one. If you were to enact a law, so you can wave your magic wand and enact a law that you believe would help people with their financial health, what would it be?
I don't know if this makes much sense, but it's just coming to my mind because it was something I heard a long time ago and it sounded neat, which was that apparently so many of the Canadians, and probably, you know, in most countries, the families that are using payday loans, they have to do it because they're only getting paid on a 2-week cycle. And so they don't have the ability to, like, they're trying to make ends meet up until the next payday. And it always occurred to me that I don't understand why we don't incentivize or figure out ways to have people get paid on a daily basis. So it seems to me that a lot of the financial hardship that people endure is based on an entirely arbitrary rule that we've set up that probably has to do with legacy systems before we modernize things, that you have to wait 2-ish weeks to actually receive funds in your account. And that just seems like we can do a lot of things these days. I don't know why you don't get paid on a daily basis.
That's an interesting one. It'd be kind of cool to experiment around that. You know how some people experiment around 4-day work weeks and just see if that helps. I mean, I guess the rule or what the advice people would have is, we'll just budget, but that's not sometimes very easy to do. So interesting one. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And again, we will have the report link in the show notes. So again, Dan, thanks so much for coming on. Dan Skilleter of Social Capital. Well, that wraps up this edition of Strictly Money. Thank you for watching. Thank you for subscribing and for all your comments and feedback. I really appreciate it. If you haven't subscribed already, please do so. And remember, you can catch this on YouTube if you're listening, or if you're watching, you can catch this on Apple or Spotify. We'll see you back here next week. Until then, stay well, stay wise, and stay wealthy.